This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Okay, yes, it's still good morning. Good morning, everyone. My name is Zvi Hirschfield, and it's my privilege to be learning with you a topic that has, even in the past couple weeks, become so controversial. I'm asking myself, how did I end up with this topic? And I can't even blame Mayer, because I think I chose it. But I chose it like 4 months ago. I did not imagine that this would be heading into the kind of waters we are heading into. But I think there's a positive in that, and that it's timely. We are thinking about these questions a lot. We are emotionally reacting to these questions a lot. I want to be clear from the get-go, and Josh here is my witness. The sources I am bringing are not designed or meant to convey an opinion or an approach that I'm endorsing. But rather, the sources are here to sort of surface the conflicts and the issues that are going to come up. I also realize that for many of us, for a variety of reasons, the issues that are going to be touched upon here can hit us in a very personal way, with our own stories, our family stories, our belief about what's happening in Israel right now, which I think is fine and great. But I just want to I want to remind us all, I'm sure there are different views in the room, and that's also a positive, right? A Beit Midrash is designed to quite literally hold or contain differing views. And so I imagine for some of us, our tolerance for different views might be tested a little bit today, which I think is healthy. Okay, so we're going to begin with the first source. I just want to read it out loud together. Actually, you know, before I begin, just a quick question. How many people like being coerced? Who here says, yes, I like being coerced?
Sometimes.
Can you give an example when you like being coerced? Got it. It's an interesting line, though, encourage and coerce. I guess there is a point where one becomes the other, but I still like to think that encouragement means somebody kind of supports your choice, but you still have a choice, and coercion usually suggests that you don't really have a choice, or if you do, your choice is, I'm going to do it, but pay a consequence, right? So what is it about coercion that we don't like, typically?
We're not given a choice.
Why does that bother us? Why is it so bad not to be? Some people find it a relief not to be given a choice, right? Because all the responsibility of choosing, for example, I hate being asked where everybody wants to go out for dinner when the family is together. I literally would prefer eating ice cubes out of the freezer than having that conversation. Because that conversation is so awful. Okay? But why is choice so important to us?
Our identity.
It's part of our identity, right? We see our choices perhaps as a reflection of who we are, and we want that to come out. Why else?
Well, choice is inherently an indication of personal freedom.
Okay, freedom, right? We seem to value freedom, the idea that we have the capacity to choose and be who we want to be and what we want to be seems to be very basic to all of us. Ah, we're going to talk about that. The question of society, right? Is there such thing as a society that actually gets rid of coercion altogether? And I think we're going to say, you know, certainly not, right? And we're going to talk about some of those lines and where they are drawn. So remember to come back to that point that's extremely helpful that we're going to have to think about. There might be limits to what we are allowed to choose. But at least as a starting point, particularly those of us that come from a Western modern background, the ability to choose seems to be so linked to our sense of personal dignity and identity that to do without it feels very difficult, feels very stifling and perhaps even painful. Yeah?
I would take back further than that. I would think Judaism is based on the idea that God has given men free will and that we're free to choose the wrong way, but you know, he tells us it's the wrong way. But
well, that's a really interesting question, right? Coercion doesn't imply there's no free will. However, by the fact that coercion says, well, if you choose to park there, we're going to fine you, one could argue their freedom of choice has been limited. I understand what you're saying. A person could say, well, I'm always free to choose, right? I can choose to do this and pay a terrible price if I do it. But I think somehow, when we talk about freedom, we want more than that. We want the ability to make our choice and not pay a price for it, right? I want the ability to choose to wear this shirt and not that shirt without being arrested for wearing the blue and not the white. In other words, I think when we say we want a life without coercion, we usually mean we want the freedom to sort of make our choices without an outside pressure trying to influence what we choose. But your point is still well taken, the distinction between free will, which all of us have, and coercion, which seems to load the dice, if you will, in favor of one over the other. There's a hand back over there. You don't?
No.
That was part of the criteria of acceptance into this program.
I got up to 600 and then...
Fair enough. We'll let you squeak by without the other 13.
But there are things there that I would bet most people or a lot of people don't particularly want to do. And so would that be, if you're adhering to Jewish law, would that be considered...
Well, what a beautiful segue. How about you read for us the first source and the source sheet and you tell me if there's coercion. It's from Exodus chapter 31.
You shall keep the Sabbath, for it is holy for you. He who profanes it shall be put to death. Whoever does work on it, that person shall be cut off from among his kin.
So it sounds like coercion. What's coercive? Come on. You have the choice. You can either keep the Sabbath because it's holy for you, or you can break the Sabbath and
die.
There's choice. So it's a very, right there, and this is not foreign to the Tanakh in general. The idea that there are divine commands, that's one piece of it, but that in addition, our freedom to choose is limited. There is coercion in the sense that the Bible is filled with examples of punishment for failing to follow God's rules. Now, think about what that would look like today. Imagine a society, imagine if in Israel, God forbid I will add, people could be put to death for violating Shabbat, right? As I think as Westerners, we don't even know what to do with a verse that says breaking Shabbat comes with a death penalty. Because we are so used to having religious expression in particular being really free and not coerced. The idea that the society can force individuals to follow certain religious laws and rules is, on the one hand, very foreign to our modern way of thinking about how the society that we want is constructed, but it's not foreign to the Bible. It is not foreign to Judaism. So really, we're going to have to think about today, really, what are the implications of that? And I think you can already see how some of the tensions that are happening today in Israeli society, if we take out the issues of power and politics, which I think actually account for a lot of it, but if we take that out, you can see readily two competing worldviews in terms of one worldview which says freedom of choice and how we practice religiously is essential to our identity as dignified human beings who want to live freely. And another side that says religious law is not up to individuals to choose. It's given, and therefore society can decide this is how everyone must behave. So, with that in mind, we are now going to jump ahead from the book of Exodus to Ezra and Nehemiah, which was a period, by the way, of a heck of a lot of religious coercion. Okay? Just so we know, if the pilgrims had been living then, they would have gotten to America much sooner. So, what I'd like you to do is take a look at source 2 and 3 and see what's going on there and then we'll come back and talk about what type of coercion is happening with Ezra and Nehemiah. I'm assuming you've already gotten the historical context. Is that a fair assumption? So we know that the Jewish people are struggling to reconstitute themselves as a nation in the land of Israel after a period of exile. And it's not a simple task.
I don't like to use the word assume, but are we saying that those, that Ezra and Nehemiah, and I haven't read this yet, right, are talking this way because in Babylon, the Jewish people were not as medactic about following some of the rules or laws?
That's a great question. It's hard to know what the Jews of Babylonia are doing at that time. It could be that things here are more difficult, or it might be the problems that were, you know, that are happening in Babylonia somehow are more critical now that we are trying to reconstitute ourselves back in the land. So both are possible. Either the people that are coming back are more problematic, or the problems are the same, but in this setting and context, they are much more threatening. We're open to both. It's a great question, which I couldn't answer. I think both possibilities are present. So let's take a look at these passages, and then we'll come back and talk about them, okay? Hey, everybody. Let's talk about coercion. And I hope everybody here took a lulav on Sukkot. Or it's going to get ugly real fast. I went in order of what I thought were the easier examples to the tougher example. Let's start with the example from Obatra. It's part of a fascinating discussion of... See, the word charity here can be misleading. Stucca as charity is a tough translation. And we'll see why. They begin with what authority is involved in collecting tzedakah. Now think about that, right? Because when we think of tzedakah, what is tzedakah? Josh, you know something about tzedakah. What is tzedakah the way it's understood in the common parlance of Jews?
Voluntary.
It is a voluntary contribution.
Preferably to Pardes.
Preferably to the Tzvi Hirschfeld Fund, I think. Right? It's a voluntary contribution. Where a person says, this is meaningful to me, this is important to me, therefore I'm going to invest my resources in it because I think it will do good in the world or advance my vision. But ultimately, it is voluntary. What is tzedakah in this context? Yeah?
It's a commandment. It's not a choice.
So number one, it's a commandment. Everyone's obligated to give. But there's also something else going on. Who took care of the poor in their society? The rich, the people who had, took care of the have-nots. Who takes care of the poor? We could debate how well it does it. But in Western societies...
Federation.
Well, you said federation, which is an interesting one. The state. The government. In other words, what happens to this text if I talk about what is the authority of the tax collector? Does that change our understanding of the text? Meaning, is it legitimate for the IRS to garnish people's wages or confiscate their property to force them to pay the taxes and bail?
It's a law.
Yes.
I mean, it's a law.
Okay, but is it a legitimate law?
Yeah.
There are people in the States who say it isn't, right? I always read about those people, like, there's no constitutional right in the federal government to take my money, right?
They spend a lot of time in jail.
I would imagine they probably spend some time, or living off the grid in Wyoming, right, where they can't be found. But, huh? Oh, that's, well, I'm not going to go down there, but yes. So, you're going to be in trouble here, cousin.
Yeah. But so, just to be clear, I mean, I think tzedakah in this context only refers to taking care of the poor. It doesn't refer to giving money to the orchestra. It doesn't refer to, it's really just taking care of the needy, the poor.
It's a great question. And I think there are edges, right? I agree with you. I don't think they're thinking of museums and orchestras. But what about school for the kids? Or what about improving the wall of the city, which also comes up? And what about water and the sewer system?
And what about rebuilding the synagogue? Right? So on these, my sense is talmudically that all the communal needs are included. The poor are a major piece of it, but they're not the only piece. So again, what justifies the government to forcibly take taxes? Why is that coercion okay? Okay, so number one, you can argue because we all benefit. And therefore, if we all benefit, we all have to contribute. It's not fair that some people shoulder the burden and other people don't. That's one way we all benefit. Why else could we argue society can do? Yeah.
As it is a commandment, you're just fulfilling basically God's will. That this is what the community needs to do in order to survive well, and you're just fulfilling what God told them to do.
Okay, so that's already going to lead us into the next text, but how this gets extended, right? That it's God's commandment. Therefore, the community can act sort of as a representative of divine will and force people to comply. There's another model that says society can choose norms and laws for itself and force individuals to comply, right? The group has the power or the authority to determine for individuals what they must do in order to remain as part of the group. In other words, as someone said earlier, coercion seems to be a natural part of group or communal living. So when we view this text not as tzedakah, but rather as a tax, I think the text is easier for us to understand. That way, when the gabbai, when the community representative comes into the person's house and starts taking out dishes and tables and chairs, we don't react with horror, perhaps, because when we see it as a tax, we might say, well, yeah, that's what the tax authority can do. They can garnish your wages. They can repossess your house. They can do things to force you to pay as a community member who's obligated to pay taxes. Yeah.
Because we don't equate giving charity with taxes, we view this as somewhat with horror, yet as you stated, we view this as the norm. I mean, if you don't pay tax, you will be coerced. And we don't view that as at all problematic.
Correct. Because we are very used to, and we'll see for very positive reasons, thinking of tzedakah as a religious or personal expression, and therefore personal religious expressions cannot be, nor should they be, coerced. But when we look at it as a communal tax, our perspective changes very dramatically. By the way, if you pay taxes to a Western government, a lot of it is going to tzedakah. Medicaid, public schools, highways, public transportation. These are all communal needs which could be seen as tzedakah. We don't think of it that way. We think of it as taxes. But if we step back and think about it, the reality is many of our tax dollars are in fact tzedakah, because they are going to maintain the public welfare and the public need. But mentally or emotionally, we have a very different sense of religious behaviors on the one hand and communal obligations on the other, and that is part of the problem of what's going on here. Because the Bible, and I think the rabbis, don't have that type of distinction that we as modern Western people draw between what belongs to our personal voluntary lives and what belongs to the realm of communal obligation, social norm, or imposed authority. All of these elements, the problem with coercion that I put up here in very bad handwriting, our need for freedom, identity, I don't want to have somebody else being the authority above me determine right and wrong, all of these things are, the fact that these belong to the individual is a very modern idea. The Bible, I don't think, sees it that way. So now we come to the next example. Let's take a look at the next example. Yes?
I don't think society saw it that way either. Usually, I think in a historical context, the king in a land would frequently have, you know, the Jewish people were a community, and they had to administer themselves.
Correct.
As long as they paid it off to the king.
Very much a modern idea. Absolutely. The Middle Ages, I don't think people had any problem with the idea that all these things could be imposed, either by church or by king. And the Jews were part of a communal identity, but not individual rights. people are very used to that as well. The idea of religious coercion is a modern problem. And we are experiencing it today in the state of Israel, which we'll come to at the end in a very strong way. And you're 100% right. Society benefits from coercion. In fact, I think you can make the case that without coercion, society can't function. No government could function if taxes were optional. And for a long time, states could not function if military service was optional. And you could argue many countries today cannot function if education is optional. And some would say even today that vaccination should not be optional. Right? These are all examples where society determines requirements for individuals to comply with. But in our perspective, the religious sphere belongs to a separate place. Yes?
There's another form of coercion today, too, and that's social coercion. Like Bill Gates puts out a proclamation, I'm going to give away, you know, 99%, and he makes it a stigma if you don't follow, if you're in that billionaire's club. In other words,
right.
A lot of
absolutely.
Is about social coercion.
Peer pressure. Social pressure, there are a lot of levers that are going on. Whenever we belong to a group, not all groups have authority to enforce in the way a government does, where a government can put you in prison or force you to pay a fine, but social groups have their own way of coercion, right? At a certain point in many communities, to attend a certain synagogue endlessly and never pay dues can become uncomfortable. It can be uncomfortable in the sense of you don't get an aliyah. They don't honor you with leading the service or being called to the Torah. Or it could be uncomfortable where someone actually approaches you and says, this isn't okay what you're doing.
Not true for Chabad.
Okay, so Chabad today is a perfect example, I think, where they are basically saying, right, since we don't want to turn anyone away, we're not going to coerce anything. You want to drive here, you want to dress here any way you like, you want to pay, you don't want to pay, it's completely open. But the flip side is, the community could feel that is really unfair. Why do I have to follow certain norms and not other people? Okay, the next example, because I'm going to quickly run out of time here, is where I imagine many of you checked out. Positive commandments. You decide one year, you know what, I'm not building a sukkah. Building a sukkah. Joe, you just decided, you know what, it is such a hassle. And the weather in Cleveland is so bad. Anyways, I'm not building a sukkah. And wouldn't you know it, Erev Chag, right before the holiday begins, the Beit Din comes to your door. And they threaten you with physical violence until you build your sukkah. Or it's Chol Hamoed, it's the intermediate days of the festival, and you didn't buy a lulav, you're not interested in lulav. Of all the mitzvot, the 613, that one really just gets your goat. I think it's silly, I think it looks very pagan, I don't like it. I'm not taking a lulav. Somehow this becomes part of common knowledge. You get a knock on your door, you better take this lulav. And if not, you're going to get it. Yeah.
So those we all react to as divorce, but you think of the Aguna situation. You know, a man won't give his wife a divorce. Maybe we're a little more sympathetic when the goons come and beat him up.
You're
until
right.
He gives his wife a divorce.
Right. But what's the key? First of all, yes. And what's the key difference there?
We agree with that. That's
true. But there's another problem. Someone else is suffering. Right? Someone could argue, what do you want from me? So I don't take a lulav. I don't like it. I don't like the lulav. What do you want from me? It's my choice. I can decide whether I want to take a lulav or not. With the Aguna case, it's more complicated. Because the guy's saying, I don't choose to give a get. It's my choice. You could say, yeah, but what about her? It's not just your choice. So the lulav example seems so extreme. How could the rabbis, even though, by the way, this was purely theoretical, to my mind, this never happened in real life. But it got codified. How could the rabbis understand that positive commandments can be coerced? How do we make sense of that? How do we understand that positive commandments can be coerced? What value is there and a commandment performed under coercion. Yeah.
Part of that goes along with the same issue with the negative commandments, that in order to maintain a Jewish society, if large portions no longer will actually live under Torah commandments, they will undermine the entire society.
Okay, so we'll talk about that, the communal effect, and this other idea of authority, right? There is a right way to behave. God commanded a right way to behave, and therefore individuals are obligated. But there's no doubt, at least in my mind, this example for us as modern people is very hard to deal with. Now, before we start to talk about the ways in which I think coercion can be understood from within Jewish sources, I want to take a little departure with you to make it clear. I don't think the rabbis believed that coercion was ideal. I think they understood that there's something very problematic with coercion, at least as a religious ideal. Take a look at this next source. It's very famous, and you all have heard it already. They stood under the mountain. This is right before the receiving of the Torah. Rav Adimi Bar Chama ben Chasa said, "This teaches that the Holy One, blessed be He, overturned the mountain upon them like an inverted cask, and said to them, 'If you accept the Torah, all is well. If not, there shall be your burial.'" What do you think? Coercion? Is that coercive? So God coerced the Jewish people by literally holding up a mountain over them and said, "Either you guys accept the Torah, or this is it. You're done. You're out. The mountain is going to land on top of you." Is that okay? Are we okay with that? Can God coerce? Right? I guess God can do whatever He wants, at least in theory. But notice what Rav Acha Bar Yaakov said. "This furnishes a strong protest against the legality of the Torah." Wow. Why is there now... There are a lot of lawyers in this room, at least three that I know of. Why is there a legal problem now with the Torah? What happens if I sign a contract? Ari, what happens if I sign a contract with a gun pointed at my head? It would what? Why not? Because I was under duress. I did not have the will to accept it. Meaning, this is a very interesting, subtle point. Even when the coercion comes from God, there's a problem. That for Torah to be... Yes, you want to say something?
But notwithstanding the coercion, if the party coerced has accepted the benefits of the contract,
That's a very interesting question. Like, in what instance can you claim you're coerced? That's already more subtle than I'm going to get to. Right now, I'm simply saying that the rabbis are aware of a problem. Of course God can coerce. But is that what God wants? Is that the purpose of acceptance of the Torah? Take a look at what they say next. Said Rava, "Yet even so, they re-accepted it in the days of Achashverosh, as it is written, the Jews confirmed that took upon them." They confirmed what they had accepted long before. This is a remarkable text. Meaning, in the time of Purim, the Jewish people voluntarily took the Torah upon themselves. And now, it's binding. Now, I don't know if that meant in Rav Acha's mind that the whole time between Har Sinai, the Mount Sinai, and Purim, the Torah is not really binding. I don't think he means that. But he is making a very powerful point. God is not only interested in our external behaviors, right? Certain things cannot be coerced. Is it possible to... Yes, Jamie? Is it possible to coerce somebody to love another person? You point a gun to someone's head, "You love this person or else." Why won't that work? Why not? Because emotions cannot be coerced. Behavior can be controlled. If we go back to our lulav case, I can force the guy to pick up a lulav. But can I really force him to like the commandment, connect the commandment, see it as a commandment? I can't force him to see it as a mitzvah, to experience it as a mitzvah. I can force the behavior. Oh, I sure can. I can stand there with a billing club and make sure he picks up that lulav and he does all the motions he's supposed to do with it. And he says, I say, you say that blessing out loud so I can hear. But think about that for a minute. What is the value of a coerced blessing? What is the value of a coerced I love you? You tell that woman you love her or else. If I found out later that someone had put a gun to my wife's head in order to marry me, which is possible, I think, knowing me. So how would that feel? How would that feel? Yes, Jamie. So.
Cool. If you're forced to do something, that action still have on the ground repercussions that have to be dealt with. Let's say you have two partners, and one partner coerced the other into having a child. The result is a human being. That human being has to be cared for.
Right.
You hold that relative over to three people and they accept it, then it sends off a string of events that have to be dealt with.
Absolutely. Torah is now in the world. And God is still going to act in the world as if the Jewish people are obligated in Torah. And I don't think the rabbis disagreed with that. What they're pointing at is a problem from our end in terms of the ultimate result. Right? You're right, that child is in the world. But that child's experience of living with parents who did not want that child versus living with parents who do want that child is still going to be fundamentally different.
Or you could say that
you're right. It might be that you can coerce somebody into a certain situation, right? What do they call it? The Stockholm effect, right? The hostages start to identify with the terrorists, right? You could coerce people into certain situations which will then affect their psychology. That's true. But at least on the surface of it, yeah. Daylights out
even
of our kids.
Even your wife.
Yes, she courses me all the time.
So you
can't wear that shirt. You can't wear that shirt. I benefit from that because I won't look like a complete idiot. Or you know what?
Right.
Those shoes have to be thrown out so I won't look like an idiot. But we coerce, it's a beautiful example. We coerce our children all the time. You have to say please. You have to say thank you. You have to go to bed a certain time. You have to eat the salad. Whatever it is. Coerce, but at the same time, if you're out with a friend who's your peer, and their parent is there, and the parent says, oh, no, you have to order the fish, and your friend complied, you'd go home feeling bad for that friend, right? At a certain point, a mature, responsible adult wants to take responsibility for their own actions and not be coerced. But your point is very well taken. Not only is coercion essential in certain cases, it creates habit, it creates change, and it can actually make us better people. Absolutely, yeah.
Well, this whole concept of fake it till you make it, meaning you may not feel it this time, and maybe by the 18th time, it begins to have meaning.
True, but at least there it's not coerced. When I choose to fake it till I make it, at least I can say, right now, here's where I am and here's where I would like to be. I'm going to adopt the behaviors of who I would like to be to hopefully create internal change. That's very different from somebody standing above me saying, I don't care what you feel, here is what you're going to do. Now, the Rambam also noticed a very basic problem with this issue of coercion. Take a look at source number 7. We're going to do that together, then I'm going to send you back into Chavruta. The Rambam here in Laws of Repentance is dealing with the issue of the freedom to choose and free will. He loves this topic, by the way. Were God to decree that an individual would be righteous or wicked, or there would be a quality which draws a person by his essential nature to any particular path of behavior, way of thinking, attributes, or deeds, as imagined by many of the fools who believe in astrology, how could he command us through the words of the prophets, do this, do not do this, improve your behavior, or do not follow after your wickedness? According to their mistaken conception, from the beginning of man's creation, it would be decreed upon him, or his nature would draw him,
to a particular quality and you could not depart from it, what place would there be for the entire Torah? According to which judgment or sense of justice would retribution be administered to the wicked or reward to the righteous? Shall the whole world's judge not act justly? What is the problem with coercion as far as the Rambam is concerned? Now, he's talking about a certain type of coercion.
The idea of fate. You have no choice but to be who you have become. You have no choice but to be the person that you are. You have no choice. This is how you were destined to be. You were born that way. Why is it such a problem for the Rambam? What's the problem with that? Listen, I'm just selfish. That's just who I am.
The whole Torah would be legislating on how to be good or how, you know, what not to do. If it's all been preordained, it's a waste of ink.
That's true.
Total waste of time. If it's all going to be determined anyways, then legislating it wouldn't change anything. What else?
What meaning is... Yes?
Punishments and rewards.
Meaningless, right? Also, right? What's the point of punishing someone if they were born or destined to be that way? Or rewarding them if they happen to be lucky enough to be born or destined to be righteous. There'd be no point. There'd be no justice. There'd be no point to justice. Yeah?
I think this whole point is beginning to control your yetzer hara, your bad inclinations, to bring them into an orderly system of functioning with your fellow man and your fellow Jew. Even though you're born a certain way, it's your responsibility as a Jew to tame that.
So let's follow up with that. It's my responsibility to deal with my own yetzer hara, my evil inclination. Oh, that's a little frightening for me to think about right now. But yes, it is my responsibility, which implies what? When I don't do it, when you see me behave in a way that is unbecoming, why do you think negatively of me? What's your assumption? Why can't I just say to you, but you know me, I have a yetzer hara. What am I going to do? So I stole silverware from your house when I stayed with you. What can I do? I have a yetzer hara. Why are you still upset? This didn't happen, folks. I want to be clear. This did not happen. It was a lovely place to stay. I gave them 10 stars on Airbnb. Best place I stayed on any trip ever, but I did not steal any. Now, let's go back to our story. Why are you disappointed in my behavior? What's your assumption?
You're not a good Jew.
But why not? I say, I have a yetzer hara. What do you want from me?
You have to overcome
it. Ah. Your assumption is, even if I have an evil inclination, it's within my power or capacity to choose not to follow. The Rambam here is saying, morality and ethics only make sense when we have the power to choose our actions. When we are free to choose how we behave in the world, then our behavior has significance. Yes?
Isn't there a confinement, there's a collective responsibility to each other that we all have to buy into it in order for it to succeed?
Well, that's an interesting question. Do we have to buy into it for it to succeed? I guess it depends how you define success. Well, if we look at the individual, religiously meaningful or morally or ethically meaningful behavior only counts, according to Rambam, on some level, when it's voluntary. Let's go back to another example. Why when I said that taxes aren't stuck up, we don't feel that way? Why not? Because they're not voluntary. Because I know when I pay my taxes, I'm not doing it, whether I want to or not, it's a fact of my life, I have to do it. Therefore, it is not meaningful on an ethical level. Even though, on the ground, you're paying for all sorts of ethically meaningful things. There are hospitals and medicines and poor people and roads and trains and buses. There are all sorts of great things everybody in this room is helping to pay for. And yet none of you want to stand up and say, I'm a tzaddik, I paid my taxes this year. Because they're not voluntary. It is through the voluntary gesture that there is deep and profound meaning. And Rambam is saying the pursuit of the ethical, of the moral, of the just requires freedom. Coercion cannot create a moral human being. It can create perhaps a moral behavior. We can coerce people to behave in ways that we want them to behave. Back to the parenting model. You could punish a child into doing anything, in theory, if you just keep raising the ante of the punishment. You will get compliance in most cases. Right? There are schools that used to get kids to behave perfectly because the repercussions for not behaving were so severe. The question, though, is that education? Well, it depends what my goal is. If my goal is the child should sit there and behave, the fear and repercussion coercion model works. If I want the child to love what they're learning, to find it personally meaningful, to grow, coercion will not help. And Rambam's assumption is religiously meaningful behavior cannot only be in the realm of the behavior. It also, by definition, requires an internal sensibility, and that internal state cannot be coerced. So for Rambam, coercion poses a serious problem. So we're now at a certain point of tension. On the one hand, we've made the case why the community and society needs coercion. On the other hand, even within the rabbinic stream itself, coercion creates a certain problem. Namely, coercion cannot create a relationship with God, a spiritual awareness, a change in the person, or a moral attitude. Yeah?
But a hungry child who's fed really doesn't care about your moral merit.
Absolutely. Which is why we might say, of course we're going to take tzedakah and take taxes. Because the needs are there, and the purpose in taking tzedakah by the community is not maybe to transform people into tzaddikim. It's to take care of certain communal needs. But the problem, we get to the example of lulav, it gets tougher.
Yeah,
right? And that's where our inclination to divide them is present. But we could still argue, as was argued here before, and as Ezra or Nehemiah argued, maybe all the mitzvot have that component to them, that the community has to follow them, even if everybody's not feeling it, for the sake of the communal norm. So, let's take a look at some models of dealing with why coercion could be justified within the rabbinic literature. Take a look at from sources 8 till the end. Okay, we're back. Sorry, people listening on tape. What are we going to do with this problem? On the one hand, it would seem the communal, national, societal structure requires coercion. The question of how far that coercion goes is going to be a matter of serious debate. But I think all of you agreed, at least on some fundamental level, belonging to a group or a collective, there's going to be coercion. At the same time, individual meaning and purposefulness seems to mitigate against coercion. You can force me to take the lulav under penalty of knocking my teeth out, but you can't force me to want to see it as a mitzvah, to connect to God through it, or to be influenced by it. I can grit my teeth and do what you're forcing me, but where is the righteousness or justice in that? So Maimonides, quite famously, based on this passage in the Talmud says if somebody refuses to give a divorce, right, you have a problem, because on the one hand, divorces, and chalitza for that matter, can only be given willingly. As Ari told us before, an action performed under duress in many cases won't have any legal meaning. You can force the person to give the get, but that action will not have legal significance because it was coerced. So the rabbis got around that to say, he is subjected to pressure until he says, I am willing. He is subjected to pressure until he declares, I am willing. Well, how does that solve the problem?
Voluntary.
Okay, so one way you could say it's voluntary. He has chosen to give a get as opposed to choosing to get his teeth knocked out. He chose. Which I know many of you are thinking, oh, come on. But at least on a certain level, that seems to be what the Talmud is suggesting. Yeah. Correct. Or the person who pays their taxes because they choose that over going to jail. We don't say that you're
forced under duress to pay your taxes. When you write your check to the IRS, you're not writing that check under duress, so it can't be cash. You're saying, if all things were equal and there were no repercussions to my not paying my taxes, I wouldn't pay them. But because there are repercussions, I choose to pay my taxes. Which I realize, as a religiously meaningful act, it's going to leave us short. But we could argue, as a legal act, this is an expression of willingness and consent, and it would be binding. Yeah?
But can't you also say that the man that's subjected to pressure until he is willing, because there is a negative consequence to the woman that he is denying to get to?
That would solve the problem as to why we do it. We do it because it's on her behalf. But it doesn't get us around the problem of why it's a legally meaningful act. If divorce can't be coerced, how can I coerce a divorce? So the Talmud offers us a legal navigation, which says the circumstances make it quite likely the person will choose to give the get. But at the end of the day, the actual moment of the giving is still chosen. Now for Rambam, who, as we know, the internal state matters so much, he interpreted this in a different way, in a way that many people don't like. Well, just look at the end, where he talks about how this works. Right? He talks about a person who's beaten until he performed the action he's obligated to perform, or stopped doing something he's forbidden from doing. He is not considered to have been forced against his will. On the contrary, it is he himself who is forcing his own conduct to become debased. With regard to this person who outwardly refuses to divorce his wife, here we go. You ready? Buckle up. He wants to be part of the Jewish people, and he wants to perform all the mitzvot and eschew all transgressions. It is only, we heard it here first, what's preventing him? His evil inclination. It is only his evil inclination that presses him. Therefore, when he is beaten until his evil inclination has been weakened, you like that? It's not my jaw. It's not my ribs. What's being weakened? My Yetzer Hara. It just looks like my jaw and my ribs. And he consents to the divorce. He is considered to perform the divorce willfully. Now, obviously, this is a very big jump. Now, as modern people, there's something about... Now, he solved one problem, right? This isn't coerced at all. Because deep down, we're simply making it possible for him to do what he really, really wants. My wife tells me this all the time. Deep down, you want to go to that simcha. No, I don't. Deep down, deep, deep down, you really do. Right? That happens. Now, there's a problem, though. As modern people, especially in the realm of religious behavior, this creates a very big problem. Because what's it assuming? What's the assumption? We know better. Or somebody else knows better. Which, again, fights against the very thing we spoke about. One of the things that gets us about coercion is precisely this idea that somebody else claims to know what I want more than I do, or know what I believe more than I do, or know what's right more than I do. And that element is very difficult. But when you're coming from a position where you feel you have that knowledge, as Rambam is, the Rambam would argue the Torah being the right way to behave is absolute truth. And therefore, a person who fights against that is acting irrationally as far as the Rambam is concerned. They are basically possessed. And therefore, we are not coercing them, we are helping them. In a way that, and it's a terrible example, we could say electric shock treatment helps restore a person to the personality that we think they really are meant to have. Or medicine, for that matter, right? A person suffers from a mental illness. The medicine is not said to be coercing them. The medicine is said to be allowing them to be the person that
they want to be.
Well, this is the kicker, that they want to be. So this is the problem, in that in Maimonides' case, even if the person doesn't ask for the medicine, he's getting the medicine anyways. But I'd say it doesn't really solve our problem fully unless one truly believes that they have access to the truth. Now, we might in certain cases think that we do. When it comes to a person who is violent or dangerous, we might argue we do know how that person should be. And we might even say we are going to give that person medicine against their will to undo the violent or crazy behavior, which happens. A person can be put in a mental hospital and forced to take medicine. If their behavior is seen to be so far removed from reality that they are not capable of judging for themselves, or so dangerous to other people that we don't trust them to judge for themselves.
But, yeah, I mean, like you said, coercion is happening through our religion. Isn't that part of Judaism for thousands of years, that the Torah is truth, that we have
absolutely.
To accept it, and this
yeah.
is it?
Absolutely, so which is why truth. Coercion doesn't bother or rub us the wrong way then as it does now. Absolutely. That is a very big piece of it. If you believe that the absolute truth is yours, your ability to justify imposing it on somebody else, the path is much clearer in that direction. Absolutely. Yeah?
I like the thought of coercion having multiple levels and being appropriate for some people and not others. Didn't Rambam also live at a time where halacha wasn't the same for all people as well? I mean, you had a class of tzaddikim, you had a class of higher up, and then you had the Am.
Well, I think there was an assumption in the Rambam's time, a Jew who publicly desecrated the Sabbath would be in very, very big trouble. Or a Jew who publicly, you know, ate unkosher meat would be in very big trouble. So I think that there was an assumption that basic halachic norms could be enforced. Now, if the guy didn't come to shul for mincha, would he get in trouble? I don't know. Like, the question of what types of deviations or laxity a community allows and what they don't would probably differ based on the community. It would depend. I know of a community in Israel where a guy who didn't go to Minyan, they didn't give him rides in the morning. People wouldn't stop for him and give him a ride to punish him for not showing up. So I guess it depends on the community. What is considered within the norms of laxity and what isn't? But the Rambam's approach, I think you're 100% right, assumes this idea of knowing. I know what you really believe and who you really are. You're not in your right mind. I'm going to fix that. And as I've tried to point out, in some circumstances, we're okay with that. Violent, psychotic behavior. In other cases, though, we're not, especially in the case of religious behavior, which I think has been pointed out, is very much part of our modern conception of our own identity. Let's give another example, which also might be very relevant today, and then we're going to talk about today. The Rambam brings another factor in why we enforce religious behavior or behaviors in general. He says in Source 10, Commandment 176 commands the appointment of judges and officers who will compel the following of the commandments of the Torah and return those who have strayed from the path of truth against their will. Notice he's consistent, right? Why have they strayed? Because they're going against their own internal inclination. They will command the good and warn against doing bad and will establish fences against violators. So the commands of the Torah and its prohibitions will not be left to the will of every individual. Here the Rambam is pointing to an idea that says, when it comes to the Torah, it is not a personal choice of every individual Jew, according to this conception. The Torah obligates whom, according to Maimonides' conception? All the Jewish people, at least, right? It's a collective. It is a covenant with the collective. And therefore, Rambam is saying, of course the collective has the right to force the individual, because this is part of the collective responsibility. It is on the collective to do exactly that. It is the job of the collective to keep individuals in line, to prevent the collective from crumbling. Part of the consequence of freedom of choice, as we know today and we're seeing it happen among the Jewish people, a consequence of freedom of choice is that unity and collective identity suffer. The more the individual side is strengthened, the more the national broadest side is going to take hits. It happens on a small scale. What happens when shuls break off? What happens? Well, you went from a community where 500 people used to gather together to pray together to two communities of 250 and 250. And it's justified because the individuals say, I'd rather pray in this way, with this rabbi, in this manner, and that means more to me than sacrificing my own personal experience in order to maintain the collective. That is a part of modern life. But from the Rambam's perspective, that's not ideally how it works. Ideally it works, the collective determines for everybody how we're supposed to behave and function. That is part of this covenantal project of the Jewish people. It is precisely not a matter of individual choice or preference, but it is on the collective to determine. So even though Rambam would acknowledge that there are going to be some pretty bitter, angry individuals out there who think the community is doing it wrong, the community still has the authority to ensure unity, even if individuals are going to grumble. One more model. And this model, I think, is most famous to you. This model says, and it based on in Joshua, we find this very interesting situation. It says the Israelites violated the prescription, right? They're supposed to go in and conquer this area, and everything there is supposed to be given over to God, which would probably mean given over to the tabernacle. No one's supposed to derive any personal benefit. However, the text says, the Israelites violated. How did the Israelites violate it?
One person did.
One person, Achan. The nerve of that guy. Achan violated it. And God was angry with whom? Is he angry with Achan?
No.
Who's he angry with, Joe?
Well,
Joe, how is that fair? How is that fair? I steal from the poor Barats. Okay. And then they turn on, they're going to be angry at all of Pardes? That's not fair. They should just be angry with me. How do we make sense of that? What do you mean God's angry with all of the Israelites? So the rabbis comment on that. They will stumble over one another, over the sins of the other. This teaches that all of Israel is bound one to another. From the rabbinic model, one's relationship with God is not private and personal and voluntary, but the covenantal contract is with the entire people, and therefore we are judged as a collective. And when individuals do things that are wrong or bad, from that perspective, we all pay. We're all going to pay the price. And therefore, I actually do have, according to this perspective, a personal investment in how my neighbor behaves. Because the collective is responsible. And therefore, from this perspective, I can coerce Josh to take a lulav. Because if Josh doesn't take a lulav, I could still be punished. And Josh can coerce me to build a sukkah. Because if I don't build a sukkah, Josh might be. Now, we're going to say that's not, in our modern conception of things, that sounds terribly unfair. That individuals can be held responsible for what other people do. But from the Tanakh, and I would argue from the rabbi's perspective, that is part of being a collective. Part of being collective means you share in the benefits, in the successes of the collective. When God brings rain to the land of Israel, even those nasty people who don't do what they're supposed to, they get to benefit from the rain too. And when God denies rain to the land of Israel biblically, even those tzaddikim who are the best people in the world, they also don't get rain. From the biblical perspective, God did not construct it so that the rain falls on the land belonging to the people who follow the rules and doesn't fall on those who don't, right? The temple is destroyed even though there must have been some people there who didn't deserve it. And the temple is rebuilt in Ezra's time, even though there must have been people there who didn't deserve it. That is the nature of a collective identity as far as the Bible and the rabbis are concerned. So we have a few models of how to contend with religious coercion. One model is, deep down we know what you really want and who you really are, even if you don't know. Model number two says something to the effect of, this is how communities have to operate. Unless we want everyone to go off in their own direction, communal standards and norms have to be enforced, even at the price of individuals grumbling and being denied their personal freedom. And number three, we are not only individuals, we belong to a shared collective identity. And therefore, I cannot say, you do what you want to do, I'll do what I want to do, because from this perspective, you and I are linked. It doesn't work that way. What you do affects me, and what I do affects you. So we end up, I think, with a pretty significant problem. On a communal perspective, religious coercion works. It helps build a shared, there's a shared covenant that belongs to everybody. There's a shared communal identity. We can create a common culture, and we can promote and share common values. Our problem is on the individual level. Because on an individual level, like you said at the beginning, our sense of our personal freedom, our desire for our personal dignity to live our lives the way we think our outside life reflects our internal life, our need for choice, the fact that we want this sense of empowerment that we have choice, and we want personal relevance. We want growth. We want to actualize our own unique potential, which would seem to fly in the face of being coerced and told how to behave. We have a tension. We have a problem. And I don't claim to solve it, but you are now living that problem that the Jewish people are facing, I would argue, in a unique way in a Jewish state. Because in most instances, if you are living in the diaspora where religious freedom is protected, every group can choose for themselves how they want it to be done. Each denomination can build their own day school, their own synagogue or temple, worship the way they want to worship, function the way they want to function, and even choose when they want the collective to work together or where they don't. The state of Israel, we're stuck in the fact that we are stuck with one another. There's only one Kotel. There's only one Jerusalem. Public space on Shabbat. Military conscription, is that the term? These are all issues where if we leave it up to the individual, we'll have chaos. If we deny the individual, we'll have chaos. Or pain, or suffering, or insult. Now, this is a debate on the strategic level, which we could argue society here has to figure out where coercion will fail, even from the perspective of the coercer. Right? Where do you lose more than you gain by trying to force people into something they don't want? But there's also broader questions of how to maintain unity and who's part of that unity you want to maintain. From the perspective of many Israelis, the Jews living here is a unity that you want to maintain, and most Jews living here do not object to the Kotel being operated by Orthodox standards. I think that's a very flawed perspective, personally, because I believe Jewish unity encompasses far more than the 8 million or 7 million Jews that live here, but it must, by definition, encompass millions of Jews who live worldwide, and therefore the perspective is off. But you also have, I think, a real clash of worldviews that's going on. You have a classic perspective that really emphasizes this national communal covenantal identity and assumes that individuals have to sacrifice in order to protect these shared norms. And in addition, which I didn't put up here, believes that they know what's right. And therefore, of course, they have the authority to enforce what they know is right. And a modern identity that says, first of all, nobody knows what's right. I know just as well as anybody else. Number two, depriving me of my freedom and my choice, you are depriving me of my identity and you're depriving me of my dignity.
And that is actually an unethical, horrible way to behave. So think about this, and we're going to close with this idea. I've got no answers. Surprise. Each side believes they are acting in a justified, ideally. I'm not so convinced everybody involved is acting from pure motivations, especially on the religious side of things. I shouldn't propagandize that way. But I would say that each side, in a best-case scenario, believes they are acting in the highest moral, ethical, and religiously meaningful way to behave. But their perspectives on what constitutes ethical and religiously meaningful are quite far apart from one another. And when you're trying to share a space, this challenge becomes really, really difficult. So for some, religious coercion is natural. That's the way God set it up in the Torah. That's how the Jewish collective operates. That's how the system operates. And for others, religious coercion undermines the very nature of what religiously meaningful behavior means and undermines the very purpose of meaningful Jewish living. How you want to resolve this, we'll save that for a year from now. Thank you very much.
This is a production of the Kodesh Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.